Welcome to the ProWrestling.net All Access Podcast. Today is Tuesday, August 24th. I'm Jason Powell of ProWrestling.net. Before we get into a review of Monday's Raw show, a few things to plug today. First off, very excited to announce that the Android app for ProWrestling.net is now available. We've had a lot of requests for that, and it's taken some time, but it is now available, and you can access that for free by if you have an Android phone by going to the marketplace at Android and entering ProWrestling.net or Pro Wrestling, and it should pop right up. And again, it's totally free. And of course, we already have the iPhone app as well. And so I hope you guys will take advantage of that. Also, I will be on the PW Torch livecast this afternoon at 4:30 Central Time, along with PWTorch.com's Wade Keller. And we'll be talking about all the, whatever you guys bring up, because it's a free show that's available at blogtalkradio.com, and callers are welcome. And .NET members can look forward to hearing the exclusive post-show that we do specifically for members of the Torch and .NET websites. But it's a one-hour show, begins at 4:30 Central Time at blogtalkradio.com. And finally, I want to sneak in a plug for myfantasyleague.com. This is a website that I moved all of my leagues to last year. As some of you may know, I covered fantasy football for a living for four years, working at fanball.com. And let's just say that the system that I was using, I'll let you guess which one it was, failed miserably last year, and was in a pinch and had to make the move, and went with My Fantasy League. And let me stress, there's no S at the end of that. It's MyFantasyLeague.com, not leagues, just league. And I had zero complaints. It was very smooth and very affordable. So if you guys are looking for an online scoring commissioner service, I highly recommend MyFantasyLeague.com. There, we've got all that out of the way. Let's get into Monday's Raw show. I guess I don't feel too bad with all those plugs, just because it was, you waited a week for this show anyway, because it was a pre-taped show. It was taped in Los Angeles, California, after last week's live edition of Monday Night Raw. And, boy, you could tell, just based on the live crowd's reaction. If you didn't know it was a pre-tape show, you're probably sitting there going, man, this is a dead crowd. But bear in mind that they sat through the live edition of Raw and whatever else WWE taped that night before this show went on the air. And it was just a flat crowd. I mean, they got excited at some key moments, but there were some other things where they just kind of sat there at times when you'd think, if this was a typical one edition of Raw only kind of show, they would have popped for us. So I thought that kind of hurt the overall show. And I like the initial hook of having Sheamus sit on the throne on top of the stage to watch the matches, and the idea that he was going to pick his Knight of Champions challenger to a point. I guess there's a couple ways of looking at that. It was a nice hook if you wanted to see what Sheamus would be watching throughout the show. But at the same time, it almost kind of sent the message that, well, you can just tune in at the end of the show to find out who he's going to select as his opponent. And, so I guess it just kind of depends on how you looked at that. I didn't think this was a great edition of Raw. I gave it a very minor hit in today's hit list, which you can read at ProWrestling.net if you're listening to this on iTunes. And it just was kind of lifeless because of the crowd. I thought there was solid build toward the main event of the Night of Champions pay-per-view. Even people who tuned out for the bulk of the show and tuned in to see that announcement at the end of the show, at least they got to see that. Problem is, I can't say I'm excited about another multi-person or another multi-challenger title match. And I'm fearful that we're going to get the same thing on the SmackDown side. Generally, when WWE rolls out these gimmick matches, if there's one for Raw, there's one for SmackDown. And it's not that I don't think we can get a quality match out of a six-pack challenge. I think the wrestlers that are involved on the Raw side of things, it's Sheamus defending against John Cena, Randy Orton, Wade Barrett, Chris Jericho, and Edge in the six-pack challenge. I mean, that's is pretty much as good as it gets on the Raw side. And so I think they can have an entertaining match, but you would think that WWE would have learned a little something from those Fatal 4-Way pay-per-view numbers. And maybe they're chalking it up internally to just being bad, you know, a bad time for the pay-per-view, whether, you know, I'm trying to think of when exactly that was, but, you know, whatever their reasoning is, I don't know if they're just blowing off the possibility that fans are kind of bored by the multi-challenger matches and want to see more singles matches. I was surprised that that Fatal 4-Way pay-per-view absolutely bombed compared to even the other numbers that were down for last quarter. I mean, that was the one that just stuck out like a sore thumb. I think it was 148,000 buys. I could be off on that, but it was really a disappointing number for WWE, and I think they're just ignoring the possibility that fans are a little burned out on the three-way, that, you know, the triple threat matches, the four-way matches, and now the six-pack challenge. And it's, you know, it's like, can we get back to having some singles matches on pay-per-view for championships on a regular basis? I don't mind multi-person matches, but WWE tends to go into overkill mode on those, and looks like this pay-per-view will be no exception. I do not, I've not looked at the spoilers. We didn't get them sent to me for Friday, this upcoming Friday night SmackDown, which was also taped last week, so I don't even know if they announced a six-pack challenge for that show or not. You guys might be ahead of me on that one, just coming back from vacation. And so, started back yesterday. So a little bit behind on some things. So bear with me, but, we'll start at the top of this show. You can follow along with me. I'm not going to read word for word from my report, my live coverage report that was posted throughout last night's Raw. But if you want to follow along, that's available at prowrestling.net, and, just look for the 8/23 Powell's WWE Raw live coverage, and you'll be reading basically what I see, and you can follow along as we go through this. We opened up with the recap from last week, and we got Justin Roberts introducing Sheamus. That's when Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler checked in on commentary. They did have some updated commentary in there. I don't know how much of the show was, they had a comment about Tiger Woods and his wife getting divorced, so that had to be something that was added yesterday. I think they were fairly specific, so it wasn't like it was just a joke in general about their likely divorce or something. I think it was specifically added. Then they also had the footage from China that was added to the show. So there was some, you know, post-production work done by the announcers. I just don't know how much. Jerry Lawler, they actually did this as Sheamus was heading to the ring. And then we got Sheamus going to ringside and mocking some fans and calling a young girl fella and just basically picking on kids, and it was fun. Sheamus turned his attention to Randy Orton, and the fans were chanting and complained about the fans chanting RKO, which is the easy way to get the fans to chant RKO. Sheamus said the general manager and he have not been on the same page lately, and he urged the general manager not to give in to Randy Orton and give him another championship match, saying he should be punished, locked up, and put in prison. And he added that Orton should never get another shot at the WWE Championship. And, of course, if they hadn't given us the cheap finish and Sheamus had gone over, Randy Orton would have went to the back of the line following SummerSlam, but they gave us a cheap finish. The general manager, actually, the email chime sounded, and Michael Cole stood up at the podium to read the anonymous general manager's email, and he said, the GM doesn't have a problem with Sheamus. In fact, he feels that he should be rewarded. And Cole called for stagehands to bring out a throne, and they set it up on the stage, and then the GM said that Sheamus would actually determine his own challenger by sitting on the throne and watching all the matches during Raw. He said Sheamus would pick his own opponent for Night of Champions. And Sheamus said, finally, some justice for me. And that's when they went to the first match, and it was Edge coming out, and he and Sheamus kind of crossed paths on the stage as Edge was coming to the ring, and Sheamus was headed to his throne up on top of the stage. And they went to a commercial. When they came back, we got an ad for the 900th episode of Raw. Generic ads. I mean, cool ads. A lot of shots of, you know, Steve Austin, Rock, and some of the bigger names from Raw's history, and I like that. But they really did, I mean, they talked about it consistently, but they didn't really give you that major hook. It's not a three-hour special. I mean, it was implied that the, you know, Raw and SmackDown wrestlers would both be there, but it wasn't like they announced a big main event or anything like that. I think they're just banking on the fact that it's the 900th episode being enough to get people to watch. And personally, I'm fine with the fact that it's not a three-hour show. I just don't think WWE has done a good job lately with those three-hour broadcasts. And I mean, if they could ever figure out a way to book a good, strong three-hour show, I'd be all for it. But in this case, you know what? Less is more sometimes. I know there's some people out there that just will get that call on the live cast on a regular basis. Why isn't WWE Raw 3 hours? Just, you know, I mean, think about how great that would be. And it's like, well, because a lot of times they seem to be putting filler in there for a two-hour show. When they do go 3 hours, the SmackDown brand is generally included, and that's not something they want to do on a regular basis. And I just think it would lead to overkill. So I'm just fine with them going 2 hours. I had a reader point out to me this morning via email that I think it was the 800th episode of WWE Raw. WWE, for some reason, celebrated it twice, which was strange. They had their, you know, they hyped it as the 800th episode, and then they came back, I think, with another three-hour special to hype the 800th episode. I couldn't remember the specifics on it, but when he pointed that out, I was like, yeah, that's right, they did. So I hope we just get one celebration for the 900th episode of Raw, despite the fact that it is a hell of an achievement for him. The first match of the night was Edge pinning R-Truth in 4 minutes and 20 seconds. Full entrance for R-Truth, which I'm completely burned out on. I think it keep it around for the house shows, but the less I have to see of it on television every week is fine by me. Truth just feels like a, you know, mid-card guy that's really never going to become more than that. I know he had his run with the U.S. title, but I don't think anyone really took that all that seriously. He's a fun act for the house shows. People seem to enjoy singing the song when he comes to their town once every 6 months or whatever it is. But it was never in doubt. There was never any doubt in my mind going into this who was going over. Granted, I saw the spoilers, but you know what I'm saying? It's not like you think, ooh, R-Truth's got a chance to beat Edge. And Truth is just kind of in that spot where fun act, but he's never, you know, you don't really take him as a credible threat when he's in there with the main eventer. And even if he does go over, you just, you know, it's going to be in a fluky, it's going to be in fluky fashion, and, you know, don't expect a big, you know, much more of a push for R-Truth than he's getting right now. The match wasn't bad. Edge missed a spear. Truth went for his big kick finisher, like an axe kick, and Edge avoided that and then nailed the spear on the second time around to get the pin. And then he looked up at Sheamus and took a mic and said, Sheamus could sit on his throne and brag about all the people he's defeated, but he hasn't defeated anyone until he beats the Rated R Superstar. As I mentioned in the hit list, Edge is just kind of lost in the shuffle right now. It's like they're taking care of him by putting him in, you know, the team WWE versus Nexus, and obviously he's part of the six-pack challenge match that they booked for Night of Champions. But it just doesn't feel like this, you know, when's the last time Edge had a real program with someone? He's just kind of that guy they're plugging in here and there, and they doesn't feel like they really know what to do with. And when I see that, and there's a big, you know, move from SmackDown from my network TV to Sci-Fi coming up, I always wonder, okay, they really don't have this guy in a program. Could he be someone they move? I mean, granted, they could put him in a program next week, and if they want to heat up Edge versus Jericho again, they could. If they want to put him in a tag team and have them go after Hart Dynasty, they could. I mean, it's not like he's a lost cause or anything, and they are trying to take care of him, but we'll see. I do expect some type of movement leading up to October 1st, if not on October 1st, when they have that live edition of SmackDown on the Sci-Fi Network for the big move, just because I think they need to beef up the SmackDown brand a little bit. You know, when the draft occurred, I was someone who believed there was a chance that Randy Orton could be moved over. Heck, maybe he still could be. But I think that they, you know, SmackDown's kind of been in limbo now for a while, and I think they need to do something to add a little more star power to it. It's not ever going to be positioned as being on par with Raw. Raw is the flagship show. That's Vince McMahon's baby. I mean, I've told you guys stories in the past about how, you know, not every week by any means, but there have been times when, you know, Vince's entire focus is on Raw. Some of the creative meetings for Raw will take forever, and then by the time they get to SmackDown, it's almost kind of a rush job, and, you know, let that creative team kind of handle the bulk of it, and Vince might, you know, throw out a few suggestions here and there. But and there are other times where he's really into SmackDown too, but you never see it really sway. It doesn't. It's not like they breeze through Raw and then they spend a lot of time on SmackDown. I'm trying to think if I've ever heard a situation like that come up. So the point being is it's going to be still the B show, but they're going to take it a lot more seriously, I believe, now that it's part of the Universal family and on Sci-Fi. And rather than just, you know, being kind of out there in limbo like it has been on my network, why would you invest a lot of time and energy into a show that's in a lame duck situation like they have been? We got the announcers hyping Cena versus Miz for later in the show, and we got a teaser for Cody Rhodes' appearance on Sci-Fi's Warehouse 13. It was an extended teaser, and I think we got more hype for Warehouse 13 on Raw than we have for anything on NXT, which airs on the same network as Warehouse 13, and is a WWE product. And we get those generic ads every week, you know, tune in to see who's eliminated next, or, you know, what, they might push one thing, but it's always really generic, and it really doesn't, get me excited about watching NXT. So I guess they're taking care of their network partner here for the Cody Rhodes appearance on Warehouse 13, but, I'm always surprised at the lack of hype that Raw gives both NXT and SmackDown. We got still shots from WWE's show in Shanghai, China. We do have a review of that show, believe it or not. Yes, we do have readers in China, and one of them was nice enough to pass along the details, not only about the show, which was pretty much a, you know, standard WWE house show event, but also kind of the scene outside the building. It was a free show, and you had to line up to get passes, and there was a lot of commotion because they gave away all the passes, I think, by and large, before people were in line even. And so there, like, the police had to be called in, and the fans kind of protested by going through the police barricade at one point. It sounds like it was kind of a crazy scene over there, and you can find out all the details on that in the WWE news section at ProWrestling.net. Second match tonight was Chris Jericho defeating the Great Khali, led, lucky us, Ranjan Singh in his corner. Jericho won via submission in 3:55. Very surprised to see Great Khali lose via submission. Not that there's anything wrong with it. I mean, I kind of mock the fans when they do or WWE actually for basically encouraging the fans to chant, "You tapped out." Following, you know, if a wrestler taps out on pay-per-view, it's not uncommon to hear that one. There's no, you know, UFC and just MMA in general have shown us there's no shame in a guy tapping out, but you'd think they protect the giant a little bit. I was kind of surprised by that, but I'm not going to lose any sleep over it because I just don't think you can get a ton more out of Great Khali. He's a, you know, kind of a freak show side act kind of thing, and they have their place in wrestling, too, but, you know, I certainly didn't want to see Jericho lose this match. I just was surprised at the way it went. But kudos to Jericho for really going out of his way, I thought, to have a passable match with Khali. I mean, this is not anything anyone's going to be talking about as a match of the year candidate, of course, but, you know, you think about some of the Great Khali's usual matches, and this was significantly better, thanks to Jericho working hard to, you know, just keep things interesting. Khali did have his moments in this one, but Jericho took a shot at his injured knee and then applied the Walls of Jericho, and Khali eventually tapped out. And I thought, you know, if they're going to work in the injured knee, maybe they'd do something where there's some kind of, you know, not that Jericho has a real built-in submission hold for a knee, but in this case, I thought maybe they'd do something there instead to really, to give Khali that out, that, well, he's injured and that's why he tapped. But, oh, well. After the match, Jericho addressed Sheamus, saying that Edge isn't the best in the world at what he does. I am. Which left me wondering, wait, aren't they back on the same page? Does this mean they're not anymore? They like each other. They don't like each other. They like each other. And now that they're going to be a part of the six-pack challenge, I guess they don't like each other again, because they've got to establish that it's every man for himself. That was a pairing that I was very intrigued by when they hooked up before Edge's injury. And they kind of failed to build up a strong rivalry between the two heading into their WrestleMania match. And again, I was a little bit intrigued when they, you know, started putting them back on the same page for, you know, heading into SummerSlam. But they just keep going back and forth with it. I don't, maybe I'm reading too much into Jericho's comment, but he continued to make his case for getting the title match. And He was standing on the second rope. When he turned around, Cauley hit him with a big chop. So I guess that's Cauley's way of getting some of his heat back. Highlights aired from The Miz and Alex Riley attacking Daniel Bryan. I think we actually saw that a couple of times during the show. Usually don't replay those same highlights more than once. You pretty much get that once, and you know, if it's a major angle, that's different, but didn't strike me as a major angle. Backstage, John Cena called Miz's attack on Bryan petty and classless, and he said Miz's mouth is has been bigger and his attitude has been worse since he won the Money in the Bank briefcase, and Cena vowed to shut Miz's mouth with an attitude adjustment. This was just kind of a generic promo by Cena. This wasn't his best work. Just kind of felt like he was going through the motions and spouting off some cliches, but it was quick. I'll at least say that much for it. After the break, we got Jillian Hall singing. She was interrupted by Melina's entrance music. Jillian Hall needs to stop. I think I'm one of the few people on the planet that actually got a kick out of Jillian Hall singing there for a while. It was definitely a guilty pleasure, and now it's just like, we get it. She can't sing. It's really not that funny. Move on. Melina got the paparazzi entrance, and I'm always like, what happens to those photos, you know? And does a baby face need the paparazzi entrance? As long as she does the splits, I think that's the only thing people care about. I don't think they give a damn about the red carpet and the paparazzi. Third match, though, was Melina defeating Jillian Hall in a non-title match in 2:35. I think it was non-title. I don't even know. Jillian won last week in a six-man and was giddy over it. So I hope it wasn't a non-title. Rich Quilling had it as a title match, and it may have been. Our correspondent also listed it as a title match, I believe, in the spoilers. But I don't know. Maybe I missed something. If it was, that's all it takes is getting your first pin in ages in a throwaway six EVA tag, and all of a sudden you get a title match the next week on Raw. What the hell? The announcer spent a lot of this match talking about the 900th episode, screaming female tennis players, and even women's golf. Jillian missed a top rope leg drop. Melina hit her sunset flip into a powerbomb finisher for the win. And then afterward, we were treated to Late Cool, the only people from SmackDown that appeared on this show to hype the 900th edition of Raw, were Michelle McCool and Layla doing their wannabe beautiful people impersonation. They're going to be at the 900th episode of Raw, and they say they have an offer that Melina can't refuse. I know this live crowd was a little flat because of the taping situation, you know, back-to-back show situation, but they didn't care, and I don't think they would have cared even if this was like the opening segment of the night. Man, it's just, Michelle McCool just has negative charisma. I don't know what it is. She works hard in the ring, but as soon as she opens her mouth, boy, she's like, oh, boy. And I think it's especially bad for people who see this as a bad knockoff of TNA's Beautiful People act. And I know Layla has said, she, you know, on Twitter that she doesn't even watch TNA, but we know Michelle McCool does. Either Michelle McCool watches TNA, or she is one hell of an innovator for her moves, from the standpoint that if she's not watching TNA, it's amazing that she's, you know, come up with the Styles Clash all on her own. And there's other things. I mean, there's other aspects of Michelle McCool's gimmick that definitely screams TNA. Backstage, Josh Matthews entered Miz's locker room and asked him about John Cena's comments. Miz complained about Cena picking Daniel Bryan over him at SummerSlam. Miz said Cena could have at least talked to him about the decision he made backstage rather than embarrass him in front of the world. And he said he's going to beat Cena and show him there are consequences for his actions. Miz said he doesn't expect Sheamus to pick him as an opponent at the pay-per-view, but it really doesn't matter because he's got the Money in the Bank briefcase. And teased that he could cash it in at Night of Champions or even tonight. Simple and effective. I like the way they have Miz tease that Money in the Bank briefcase is always in play. Nexus came out onto the stage, and while Sheamus was sitting there on the throne, he was kind of attempting to buddy up to them, but the email chime sounded. Michael Cole, on behalf of the general manager, announced that the GM was impressed by Nexus last week, and thus their ban on challenging for title belts has been lifted. And Wade Barrett walked over to Sheamus, who stood up and said, consider our truce over. So, and effective. Good. So now, the Nexus members can challenge for titles. I do wonder if this will lead to some kind of tag title scenario as well. I thought maybe that was why they had Skip Sheffield and David Otunga go over last week in a tag match, was maybe to kind of start establishing them as a tag team for a potential run against Hart Dynasty. Obviously, with Sheffield's broken ankle, he can't be part of it, but it doesn't mean they can't come up with two guys to be part of a tag team to go after Hart Dynasty, who's just kind of hanging out there in limbo right now with really nothing else to do. Then we got the highlights of Miz and Alex Riley working over Daniel Bryan again. And then in the fourth match of the night, it was The Miz defeating John Cena by DQ in 13 minutes. Cole was pro-Miz as usual. He compared John Cena not having him on the team at SummerSlam to like an NBA team just not wanting LeBron James. Cole's really over the top with this, and I'm enjoying it. Michael Cole has been a brutal announcer for a long, long time. He did some decent work when he was with JBL, especially because I think JBL pushed him. But by and large, Michael Cole's been awful. And he's just watered down. I think the fans, longtime fans, would even fans who only know him by legend at this point would rather have Jim Ross in there than Michael Cole. And I don't think that sentiment has changed. But at the same time, I find Cole to be much more entertaining now that he's, kind of become the Miz's cheerleader and he's starting to cheer for some of the heels here and there. It makes me actually pay attention to what the announcers are saying. And I try, but mentally, if there's not something like this going on, I just tend to zone them out. It's so easy to do because they're really not enhancing my viewing. It's just Jerry Lawler's got corny jokes that he's been telling forever, and he's checked out. He just shows up and does his job basically, and I guess it works for him. He doesn't get the Michael Cole or the Vince McMahon yelling through the headsets treatment like Michael Cole and the other announcers do, at least nearly as much as they do. But it's just he doesn't make for very entertaining listening, and Michael Cole is just as bad as they come on play-by-play. So this is kind of freshen things up, and I do find myself listening to Cole a little bit more than I used to. And I know people are assuming now more than ever that Cole is going to be revealed as the anonymous GM because of all the, the heel cheering that he's started to do. And that's possible. I mean, he's been a candidate pretty much since day one. He's been someone that people have been throwing out as a potential candidate to be the anonymous general manager. And I know people have kind of pointed to the fact that he's not really reading emails. It looks like he's reading from a script. And is that a clue? And boy, I hope it's not. I mean, I just think it's a sloppy move by WWE. I think he really is reading from that script rather than email. I don't know why they can't just put it on his damn computer screen, but I don't think that's a clue. Because if it is, then, okay, why doesn't Jerry Lawler point it out? Why doesn't everyone watching on, the show on television point this out? I just think it's a sloppy move by WWE, so I don't read too much into that. But I do think Cole is a legitimate candidate. The concern I have, though, is who do you turn to? If Michael Cole's the anonymous general manager and they want to keep him in that role, I guess as the GM, he would be allowed to book himself as the play-by-play guy. But at some point, you're going to have to pull Michael Cole from the air when the thing plays out or, somehow, some way. And I just don't get the sense they want to go back to Jim Ross, which they would, but I don't think they want to. And so I just don't know where you go from there. It's not like they have real high hopes for Todd Grisham at this point. I mean, there's a reason that, he's left off the pay-per-views and really isn't doing a whole lot, and they're not really spotlighting him in a meaningful way. And I just don't think they've got, if something happened to Michael Cole, let's say, he just up and quit tomorrow. I don't know what the hell they do. I guess Josh Matthews. But it's not like they have this real deep roster of potential play-by-play voices. So, but the other candidate that I see here, I guess we'll save that for later on in the show. But I think Cole is certainly one of them. It could just be, it could be somebody we're not even thinking of. I mean, they've left this open, I think, by design. But the fourth match was Miz beating John Cena by DQ in 13 minutes. Miz got a lot of offense here. This wasn't just a case of Cena getting the better of Miz until the cheap finish. They've certainly change the way they approach The Miz in the ring. It's been going on for a while now. They're trying to give him in-ring credibility. I think he needs a real win over somebody to accomplish that. Just because he's showing improvement in the ring in terms of, to the casual viewer eye, well, all of a sudden now he's a threat. He's getting near falls on John Cena. I think it's going to take more than that. I think he needs a decisive win over somebody that matters. However, maybe this is by design, too, where they give him a little in-ring credibility, but they want to leave him look a little bit vulnerable, too, so that if he does win, if he cashes in Money in the Bank and does so successfully and becomes WWE champion, maybe they want to make him that vulnerable heel champion where people pay to see him on pay-per-view and they tune in into Raw when he has a title match because they think he's always a risk to lose it. Potential scenario there. But I do think they're trying to give him a little bit more in-ring credibility at this point. But if they want to really make people see him as a heel who can win clean over anyone in that company, then they're just going to have to, they're going to have to go all the way with it by having him beat someone who matters. It can't just be a win over John Morrison at this point because they've pretty much made John Morrison feel as mid-card as anyone. But I enjoyed this match. I thought it was good work by both men. It wasn't just, it wasn't even a case of Miz just dominating and Cena doing nothing either. Good back and forth. I think Miz probably controlled the bulk of the offense. The finish was Daniel Bryan running out and attacking Miz for the DQ. I don't know why he wouldn't have just ran out to start the match, why he waited 13 minutes to do so. I was puzzled by that. But Bryan rolled Miz back inside the ring where John Cena hit his attitude adjustment. Cena left the ring and didn't seem like he was pissed off at Bryan for costing the match or anything. Bryan entered and applied his submission hold, and Miz tapped out immediately. Several referees then ran inside the ring and tried to break it up, and Bryan eventually released the hold. And Cole questioned where Bryan gets off interfering in the main event match here on Raw. So nothing too over the top there, but it's still another case of Michael Cole rooting for The Miz and hating on Daniel Bryan. I'm getting a kick out of that, especially the stuff when, did you know he's a vegan? Did you know he doesn't even own a television? Good stuff. Then we got an ad for SmackDown. It's going to be a good show. I'm sure many of you have seen the spoilers. As I said, I have not, but it's Dolph Ziggler defending the IC title against Kofi Kingston and Rey Mysterio versus Kane, and certainly implied that we're going to get the television return of The Undertaker on that show as well. That's coming up on Friday night. And Marv Herrmannstein and Chris Shore will have the live coverage for you guys coming up Friday night at .net. Then we got the fifth match of the night was Santino Marella and Vladimir Kozlov defeating the Uso brothers in 3:05. Tamina was in the corner of the Uso brothers. I think we learned last night why they've decided to play up this Santino is wanted by another woman. Cole said right off the start that Santino is like Will Ferrell's character and the other guys, and that women seem to like him for some inexplicable reason. So I think someone from Creative saw this movie and said, hey, we did that with Santino. Let's bring it back. Let's remind everyone that we did something similar. Well, congratulations, because the difference is it was funny in the other guys and not so funny in WWE. I don't like what they're doing. I don't like the Uso brothers being part of a comedy act right now. I just think it's too soon. I think they should be focused on building that team up for a tag title feud with the Hart Dynasty. Not this, stop and start stuff they've been doing with them, but a real feud between the teams because, frankly, they're, two of the only real teams in WWE right now. There's a couple on SmackDown, but I just think that's a program you can get something out of. And instead, here they're losing to the comedy team of Santino and Kozlov and just being completely outshined by this silly storyline that Tamina has the hot for Santino for God knows what reason. So Tamina is your Beth Phoenix substitute. I wonder if this is going to end with Beth coming back. I think is she technically a SmackDown diva at this point? I don't even remember. But I do wonder if somehow, some way, this leads to Beth coming back and a feud between Beth and Tamina or something, and Santino ends up hanging out with Tamina. Originally, it was supposed to be Santino, Vladimir Kozlov, and Beth Phoenix as part of a WWE sitcom that the company acknowledged, but really haven't heard anything about it since then. So I don't know what's going on with that. I can't say I'm really looking forward to it either, because it's been a long time since Santino's really gotten a laugh out of me. We got a Classics On Demand flashback of the big event that took place at Toronto's Exhibition Stadium in August of 1986. Looked great. You know, packed stadium. Hulk Hogan versus Paul Orndorff was your main event. I think probably my favorite, you know, I know Hogan Piper stands out to a lot of people. Hogan Savage stands out to a lot of people. Hogan Orndorff was it for me. I really enjoyed that that feud back way back when. I thought it was just very well done, and it's a shame that it really didn't get to play out on the big stage at a WrestleMania event, because Orndorff, man, I remember going to a show at Met Center right after they did aired the big turn with Orndorff raising Hulk Hogan's hand in the middle of the ring and then clotheslining him to turn heel on Hogan, and I went to one of their first matches at Met Center in Bloomington, which is right next to, before they tore it down, it was right next to the Mall of America, just to give you some perspective on where that was located. It was the old home of the North Stars, and to this day, I don't know that I've seen heat like Orndorff generated. I mean, there were a few people cheering for Orndorff even back then that liked the heels, but that place was just crazy for Hogan and hating Orndorff, and go out of your way to see some of that footage if you get a chance of any of that of that program that they had together. Really good stuff. We got a shot of the vacant throne on the stage before they went to a break, and when they came back, we got more hype for the 900th episode, and Sheamus was back on the throne, so maybe he had to run backstage to use the other throne. I don't know what the hell that was all about. Ring entrances took place for the Triple Threat match, and it was Randy Orton, John Morrison, and Ted DiBiase with Maurice in this one. Sheamus got up and headed backstage when the match started, and so he wasn't there to watch Randy Orton defeat John Morrison and Ted DiBiase in this Triple Threat. Boy, Morrison and DiBiase really got nothing here. They took turns kind of rolling outside the ring so that they each could work kind of a glorified singles, have glorified singles moments with Orton. But it was all about Orton. And, I mean, I get it. It's Randy Orton. He's one of your stars. But I just hate that they don't have anything right now for John Morrison and Ted DiBiase. I think Ted DiBiase and Maurice really have potential as an act. And they just haven't really gone out of their way to push them in a major way at all. And Morrison, again, he's just kind of stuck in that middle ground. The finish was, I think they wanted to kind of go for, to try to get a similar vibe to what they got when Evan Bourne did the shooting star press and Randy Orton popped up and hit the RKO while Evan was in midair, because Morrison jumped off the top rope. And I do apologize if you guys are hearing that lawnmower sound. It's the damn lawn service that the members know all too well. They'll hear me go on rants about this lawn service that's out here way too often. I'm convinced that they have the blade at the highest level possible so that they can come back like three times a week to mow the lawn and get paid for it. Drives me insane. I'm going to buy a BB gun and just start shooting these people, because I know they're out there way more than they need to be. So if you guys are picking that up, I do apologize. I would stop and save this for later, but trust me, they'd still be out there. Anyhow, where were we here on Orton? Oh, the finish was, John Morrison goes to the top rope, and he leaps off the top rope, and Morrison hits the RKO on him while he was coming down. And the great thing, you know, I mean, it's really going to be hard for anyone to top what they did with Orton and Evan Bourne. That was just special. But that felt like the great thing about that, in addition to, you know, it's always fun to see Evan's finisher, but it was his legit finisher. In Morrison's case, was like he was just jumping off the top rope to jump off the top rope, and there really wasn't anything to it. You know, it's just like, okay, so he jumped off so he could take that move. It's not like he has this great finisher off the top rope that he was, you know, it wasn't like he was going for Starship Pain or anything like that. He was just jumping off the top rope. But it was still cool. It worked. Just, you know, if you'd have seen that before Evan Bourne's taking the RKO during the Shooting Star Press, it probably would have been more impressive. But anyway, this was just all about Randy Orton dominating the other two when he hit the RKO on DiBiase after the match. And again, good for Randy Orton, not so much for the other two. After the match, we had Sheamus telling Josh Matthews backstage that he didn't need to see Orton wrestle because he'd already made up his mind and he would announce to the entire world inside the ring who his opponent would be. Now, if it's me, you know what? I'm making Josh Matthews follow me to a limousine. And I'm inside the limo with the door half open. I'm leaning out, telling him who I'm going to face. And then I slam the door and race away so that they can't spoil my mood and tell me that, no, you're not going to have that opponent. It's going to be who the GM wanted anyway. Didn't play out that way. And after the break, Sheamus was standing in the ring with the championship belt. And he said he wasn't going to wait until Night of Champions to defend his title. He called for a referee and said it was going to happen now. I talked about the opportunity that he received, and that's the only reason he was WWE champion, because he was given an opportunity. And he said he's going to return the favor by giving a shot to someone who'd never had a WWE championship match before. That person was Zack Ryder. And Sheamus ended up beating him in about 10 seconds. All this was Sheamus just blasting him in the face with the bro kick and pinning him. And that took about 10 seconds. And, yeah, that was it. And then after the match, Sheamus took the mic and boasted about the win, and he pointed out that the rules say, and how often do you hear this in WWE? And it's kind of been the long-running rule in pro wrestling, but you don't hear it brought up in WWE very often. But he did say that WWE rules say that he doesn't have to defend his title for another 30 days. Therefore, he's taking off Night of Champions. In fact, he's going to head back to Ireland for some time off, and he's all giddy at this point, but then he was interrupted by entrance music. Wade Barrett came out and confronted Sheamus in the ring. Barrett recalled winning WWE NXT and earning a title match at the pay-per-view of his choosing, and he said that he was going to cash that in at the Night of Champions pay-per-view. The email chime sounded at that point. Michael Cole stood up and announced on behalf of the anonymous general manager that he was going to oblige Barrett's request. And the crowd cheered because Sheamus has to defend the title. I don't think they were necessarily cheering for Nexus here. The GM said that four other wrestlers will also get that opportunity that Sheamus spoke of during his promo. Sheamus is going to defend that championship in a six-pack challenge at the Night of Champions show. It'll be Chris Jericho. And for every time they would announce one of the wrestlers, they'd make their entrance and then come to the ring. So it was Jericho first, followed by Randy Orton, followed by Edge, and then Jerry Lawler excitedly pointed out that there was still one more superstar to go. Who could it be? Gee, who the hell do you think? John Cena is named the final challenger, and I know it's not Lawler's fault. He's got to call it like that, but it wasn't like anyone at home thought there was any mystery. Sheamus ended up shoving Barrett into the middle of the ring once everybody was in there, and then all the WWE wrestlers, including the heels, surrounded Barrett, and Cena kicked Barrett in the gut, and then Sheamus, Edge, Jericho, and Orton joined him in putting the boots to Barrett, so he's getting a little bit of the taste of his own medicine with all those Nexus beatdowns. I'm curious to know how they're going to approach that come pay-per-view time. Wouldn't they just gang up on him immediately? I don't know. Sheamus cleared Barrett from the ring, and then it was rapid-fire finisher time. Jericho hit the codebreaker on Sheamus. Edge speared Jericho. Cena hit the attitude adjustment on Edge. Orton hit the RKO on Cena, which should have felt like a major moment, and it didn't at all. It was just kind of another moment on Raw. Nothing big. You know, it wasn't portrayed as, oh, my God, you know, that they're... I know they've got that long history together anyway, but it just... I don't know. It felt like it should have mattered more that your two top babyfaces, one of them, and I know he's not a true babyface, but, you know, he hits his finisher on John Cena, the ultimate babyface in WWE. I don't know, I just felt like it should have meant more than it did. But Orton stood tall as the announcers hyped the six-pack challenge match for the Night of Champions pay-per-view, and they also gave final hype to the to next week's 900th episode of WWE Raw. Yeah. I know what I was going to talk about. Again, the anonymous GM thing. Okay, so the anonymous GM says that he really doesn't dislike Sheamus, but then he screws him over and puts him in the six-pack challenge. Could it be Hunter? You know, I keep bringing it. I think it's, to me, in my mind, the two logical candidates at this point are Michael Cole and Triple H. And, you know, we know that Triple H is the guy that took out, or Sheamus is the guy that took out Hunter. So, you know, at first I was kind of wondering, Nexus didn't go after him because maybe they were supposed to save him for Triple H. And now is it just, Hunter's going to be out longer than we thought, so let's do something with it, with these guys. And now it's just kind of, will it turn out that Hunter's been the guy trying to kind of stack the deck against Sheamus? I don't know. But those are the two that make sense. I don't want it to be McMahon family member. I don't think anyone does. I think we've seen that storyline play out way too many times, just too predictable. But there's not, I don't get the sense that they've kind of scaled back a little bit. I don't think they're really creating a lot of mystery and intrigue about who the anonymous general manager is. When they first started it, tons of emails, as you would expect, and then that lasted for a few weeks, and it was a major talking point. And now it's just kind of, you know, it'll come up every now and again, and I'll get a couple emails here and there. But it's not like WWE, it doesn't look like they're on the verge of making that reveal anytime soon. So I don't know how long they're going to go on with this. I don't think it's turning people away from the show, but I don't know. I wish they could do a little bit better job of building up the suspense and giving us some idea of when an end date will actually occur for this thing, so that we can kind of see some light at the end of the tunnel and kind of get people asking those questions again about whether or not, who the mystery, just kind of get the suspense going again as far as who the anonymous general manager actually is. And I think until they give it some indication, some keys that we're about, you know, that reveal is in the works, then I think it's just going to kind of, the viewers are going to take kind of a business as usual approach to Raw and aren't going to spend a lot of time dwelling over who the mystery GM is. But that is going to do it for now. Again, check out the Torch Livecast today over at blogtalkradio.com. If you like this audio, there is a ton of audio on the .net members website, and you can sign up for as little as $5.50 per month. I, myself and Rich Quilling, review every edition of WWE Raw via audio, and we also review all the WWE and TNA pay-per-views in audio form. Actually, I do for the TNA. I guess Rich doesn't always do them for the TNA pay-per-views, but we've got you covered. And then there's also the weekly Q&A series where I answer about an hour's worth of the .NET member pro wrestling questions with some non-wrestling questions sprinkled in. We keep that one light and have a good time. And the flagship show of .NET Audio is the .NET Weekly Audio Show, which is usually posted on the website on Thursday with Rich Quilling and I running through all the news of the week. And there's oftentimes news items in there that haven't been reported elsewhere. And it's also, if for as little as $5.50 per month, if you take that annual option, you will have access to the ad-free version of the site, the .NET members forum, the ability to write your own blog, and much more. So if you're listening to this on iTunes wondering, well, that sounds good, how do I sign up for that? Just head on over to ProWrestling.net and look for the sign-up area, and you can be signed up very quickly and have access to all those things, including all the past audio we've done, including various interviews with Brock Lesnar, Jim, Sinister Minister Mitchell. Let me get my list up here because I'm a little bit I'm still trying to work my way back from vacation. Former TNA creative team member Dutch Mantel in his first major interview coming off his firing by TNA. That interview lasted about 3 hours long. Former WWE creative team member Court Bauer also spoke for about 3 hours. Conan's on there. Sean X-Pac Waltman joined Wade Keller and I for a review of one of the big WWE Raw shows, and much more. So, if you're interested, just head on over to ProWrestling.net. Look for that sign-up area, and you can sign up for as little as $5.50 a month if you want to take that annual option. Monthly options are also available. That's going to do it for today, everybody. Thank you so much for listening. I'll talk to you soon. Take care.